Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, City of Austin, is now in session.
Good afternoon, y'all can be seated, thanks so much. Third Court of Appeals welcomes you all to the court today, and we're looking forward to hearing from 0324439CV, Molly Veronica Tracy Trust, and Molly Tracy versus MT Quest LP et al. If I can have counsel state their name and whether they're ready today.
Yes, Chief Justice Brown, Danica Milios and Devin Gross Black for appellants, we are ready to proceed.
Thank you.
Todd Smith here on behalf of the Tranmore entities that believes we're ready to proceed, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Councils, as you're aware, we are broadcasting this live on YouTube, as well as our very sophisticated timing apparatus here. As you know, we've got the green for 15 minutes, and then yellow for two, and then the red means stop, and then for the appellee, it'll go 20, and then 2 minutes, and red for stop, and then we'll have the five-minute rebuttal. For the appellant. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started and hear from the Molly Veronica Tracy Trust et al. You may proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. 5 years ago, Molly requested Tranmore Records on behalf of herself and her trust in order to value her Tranmore interests for gift and estate tax paperwork to be submitted to the IRS. These interests are Molly's share of the marital estate after her divorce. As a result, Molly owns her interests along with her ex-husband, her ex-father-in-law, and his best friend.
I'm going to interrupt you right there because they're making it a deal that your client does not have an individual interest in this, only the trust. Is that relevant, and
it is not
so why?
Right, I'm sorry, it is not relevant because Molly submitted, I'll just refer to Molly, Ms. Tracy, as Molly, just to try to keep things simple. Molly submitted her letter requesting records on behalf of herself and her trust. She filed her lawsuit on behalf of herself and her trust. The facts behind that were Molly received these interests, as I said, as a result of the divorce. Subsequently, she transferred her individual interest to the trust. So you are correct that, and Tranmore is correct, that Molly at this point doesn't own any individual interest in either in any of the entities. It's all been transferred to Molly's trust. And importantly, TPI judicially admitted that fact in its live answer and counterclaim. So there was no need for Molly to come forward even with evidence to establish that. It is uncontroverted that Molly's trust owns the interests at issue here. The court can reverse for two reasons. Or actually two independent options. First, under California law, Molly is entitled to records because she requested records stating a purpose that is related to her interest. Molly's purpose was interest valuation. Tranmore has never articulated a reason why valuing an interest could ever not be related to the interest. Second, Molly is entitled to records under Texas law as well, because valuing an interest is undisputably a proper purpose. It was Tranmore's burden to prove Molly's purpose was improper, but Tranmore didn't do that. It disclaims its burden. For either reason or both, the court should reverse and remand for a new trial, and at a minimum, the court should reverse and remand for a new trial on attorney's fees. I'd like to start with California law. Tranmore admits that California law applies to TPI, the corporation at issue in Molly's request. Tranmore argues only that the error in not applying California law was harmless, but the harm is demonstrated by the statute. California law only required Molly to state a purpose that was to be related to her interest, not as Texas law requires, proper. Tranmore, again, as I stated a minute ago, has never articulated any argument for how the purpose of valuation could somehow not be related to Molly's interest. I would submit there isn't one. After all, as Tranmore has acknowledged in other contexts, the words or the phrase related to creates a very broad causal connection.
Do you believe that, I know that the trial court did not apply California law.
Correct.
Do you believe that California law applies to the company that's made in California, and Texas law applies to the rest of the companies not made but incorporated in California?
Yes, I think technically California law would apply to TPI, the California corporation, and Texas law would apply to the limited partnerships. But that difference would not make a difference. Would not make a difference if the court remanded for a proper application of California law to TPI, because TPI, as the general partner for all of the limited partnerships and owner of at least 1% of an interest in all of them, is the holder and is required to maintain all of the records for all of the limited partnerships, the Texas limited partnerships. And furthermore, information about the limited partnerships would be related to Molly's interest in TPI, because TPI owns 1%. So the value of each of the limited partnerships would be very relevant to and important to consider to value TPI. So if the court reverses and remands for application of California law, Molly can obtain all of the records she needs from TPI, the holder of the records. Now, if the court feels it needs to address Texas law, the trial court erred as a matter of law in its misapplication of Texas law as well. Molly had to send a written request to inspect records stating a proper purpose under Texas law. Molly did that with her letter sent back in April 2021 on behalf of herself and her trust. And that letter is proof of itself of her request, and it stated a proper purpose. At that point, as this court held in In Re Elusive, the burden shifted to Tramore to prove that Molly's purpose was improper. But Tramore has not done that. It disclaims that obligation, even in its briefing to this court. But In Re Elusive held to the contrary, and we know from In Re Elusive that Tramore did not meet its burden. In Re Elusive surveyed multiple courts of appeals decisions in Texas, and it gave a very informative summary of the types of evidence that would suffice to show an improper purpose. In Re Elusive, the shareholder had not requested documents until he was fired from his position with the entity. He took confidential files from the entity, he shared them with his new business clients, and he used his former entity's documents to try to undercut the entity. Another case with some good facts showing a properly alleged improper purpose is In Re Dyer, discussed by the court in Re Elusive. Those facts are very similar to the facts of Elusive, but a couple of distinguishing points were that the shareholder misused documents he had obtained in a prior records request, and he vowed to take the company down. So those are the types of allegations that have to come forward from the entity to even get to the jury on a question of improper purpose. Contrast that with another case discussed by In Re Elusive called Citizens for Sound Energy versus Bolts. In that case, the requesters asked for documents and received documents from the entity on multiple occasions. On their last request, the entity refused, said the requesters were acting in bad faith, there was animosity between the requesters and the entity, and the requesters already had the documentation. The Court of Appeals in Bolts held that is insufficient, those allegations are insufficient to even state an improper purpose defense because they were conclusory, there were no facts alleged, no details alleged to support an improper purpose allegation. Tramore's proof here, and I say proof loosely, doesn't even come close to what this court acknowledged in Re Elusive as good enough to state an improper purpose, but is much more in line with what doesn't qualify in Bolts. Tramore points to testimony from representatives from Tramore, Mr. Morris and Ms. Bowen. Both of those witnesses testified that they believed Molly acted in bad faith, but neither provided any details that would evidence or any facts that would evidence that Molly acted in bad faith. Morris testified that he didn't believe Molly's purpose was true because her request didn't match what she was asking for. But Morris also testified that he never looked at Molly's request, he didn't handle Molly's request, and he had never valued a business. Now, Maura Bowen testified that Molly was harassing the company. But the basis for Bowen's testimony was that Molly asked for a lot of records on a short turnaround, and she asked for way more than necessary. None of those allegations support an improper purpose allegation either. Molly requested records from all of the entities in which her trust owns an interest. That was 15 or 16 entities. By its nature, that is going to be a lot of documents. Requesting documents on a short turnaround can't be evidence of improper purpose, because Molly was entitled to records in most of her records within 5 to 10 days, with either under the Tramore, limited partnership agreements, or under the statute. And in any event, Molly's letter requesting records stated at the very end, please contact me, please contact my counsel to coordinate delivery. So if Tramore needed flexibility on the amount of time it took to turn around the records, it could have asked for it. Alternatively, Tramore could have copied all the records from Molly that she gave without challenging Molly's request and charged her for the privilege. Finally, Bowen's argument that the documents were way more than what Molly needed to value her interest is conclusory testimony that is not supported by her any qualifications. And most importantly, Molly isn't limited by the statute to what documents are needed. The reason all of this matters is, as the court in Chavko versus Pi.
Let me ask you about what you just said. So, because a lot of the findings of facts talk about whether it was necessary or not. The word necessary is not in the statute. Where did that come from?
That came from Tramore. Tramore urged the court urged the trial court to conclude, and the trial court agreed with Tramore that Molly was required to prove what was necessary in order to get any given document. She had to prove what was necessary with expert testimony. Now Tramore has abandoned that argument on appeal. You will notice there's not a word about that in Tramore's brief. Tramore does not try to support its imposition of the extra statutory burden on Molly. So every finding of fact in the trial court's findings that mentions Molly's alleged failure to prove what was necessary applies the wrong standard of proof. It applies the wrong statutory standard, it is irrelevant, and it cannot support the judgment. And the reason we don't require shareholders or partners to show what's necessary is because they are owners in a business. They are entitled to know what their interest is worth. And I'd like to point the court to a statement by Chaff in the Court of Appeals decision in Chavko versus Pybus, also cited by the court in Inri Elusive, that the right to documents cannot be circumvented by the mere conclusion that no proper purpose exists. Facts must be alleged that show an improper purpose. Otherwise, a company could prevent the statutorily required inspection of records or, at a minimum, cause delay. That's exactly what happened here. Under the correct standard and using the proper burden shifting, Molly met her statutory burden to show herself entitled to Tramore records, and Tramore failed to come forward with any evidence that Molly was actually motivated by an improper purpose. Now, upon Molly's showing, the question became, what documents is Molly entitled to review? The statutes entitle Molly to certain categories of records automatically and others as just and reasonable. The fight here is over what is just and reasonable. So circling back to your question, Justice Triana, at the trial court, the fight was about what was necessary. There was no discussion or argument about what was just and reasonable. So from the beginning, the trial court got off the track in holding Molly to this extra statutory necessary burden. But now on appeal, the court can look to the evidence in the record to conclude that the evidence at trial unequivocally showed that the records Molly's requested her proper purpose and the records that Tramore admitted to withholding at the end of trial demonstrated that it would be just and reasonable for Molly to review those records. I would specifically point the court to Ms. Bowen's testimony, where she admitted she withheld from Molly contracts between TPI and other Tramore family entities, monthly operating statements from the limited partnerships, and financial records from all of the entities. On their face, those documents would be just and reasonable for Molly to review. Contracts between TPI and other Tramore entities would show TPI's financial condition, its business activity. Obviously, monthly operating statements and financial records would reflect on the financial health of all the entities. And if the court needs further guidance on that, or if it needs further comfort that the record on its face shows that Molly, the records Molly requested would be just and reasonable, it needs look no further than IRS Revenue Ruling 5960. That is a public document available to any taxpayer who wants to submit paperwork to the IRS that requires valuing of a closely held company.
Can I ask you a question? Do you believe that you need expert testimony in order to show just and reasonable?
No, I don't. For the same reasons that we don't need expert testimony at all, because we don't need expert testimony to show what is necessary. And just and reasonable is, as the Texas Supreme Court has held on multiple occasions, is not susceptible to direct or specific proof. It is just a matter of what is within the zone of reasonableness. Now, that's a loose standard, right? But we know from IRS 5960 that there are general categories of documents that it would be reasonable for any taxpayer to look at when trying to value an interest for submission to the IRS. Those, just a couple, include the economic outlook of the company, the financial condition, the earning capacity, dividend paying capacity, and goodwill. Those are extremely broad categories, and this is not a precise test. But nothing in the statute indicates that the legislature intended a higher bar. There is no evidence supporting the trial court's findings that Molly didn't meet her statutory burden.
You mentioned the reasonableness and the zone of reasonableness, but the term just is also there. Can you explain your definition of the term just and how Tracy's requests were just, or
I actually searched for cases discussing just and reasonable in this context. Unsurprisingly, I didn't find any. But in the utility rate making context, and this is in the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Corpus Christi versus the PUC, the court held that what is just and reasonable, you've heard this before, is what is in the zone of reasonableness. Another data point for the court, I see my time has expired, Madam Chief Justice, may I complete my answer?
You may complete your
Thank
answer,
you.
Yes.
Another data point for what is just would be the attorney's fees provision of the UDJA. We know that what is equitable and just is, attorney's fees under the UDJA must be equitable and just and reasonable and necessary. Equitable and just is a question of law for the court. So the question for this court is, would it be just for Molly to review records that undeniably fall within the category of records that the IRS suggests Molly review when she is compiling her submission to the IRS for gift and estate tax purposes?
Thank you. We'll hear from you in rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Smith, thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court.
Certainly.
I wish I could say there was much room for agreement between myself and my opposing counsel about this case, but unfortunately there's not. I think the trust and Ms. Tracy have entirely skipped over the standard review in this case, and the fact that this case was, there was a motion for judgment granted during trial. The standard of review is critical and actually guides the proper outcome of this case. I don't think I heard a single word said about what the proper standard of review is in this case, other than there's an issue about who bears the burden of proof on one issue, and I'll get right to that. So the opening point I would like to make, though, is just to remind the court of the procedural posture of where we are.
And can I interrupt you, just since you said there's not much that you agree on? Do you agree or disagree that y'all have abandoned that Ms. Tracy had to show that the request was necessary?
Disagree, because it's incorrect to say that Traymore injected that into the case. In fact, it was Ms. Tracy that injected that into the case, starting with Plaintiff's Exhibit 6, the actual demand. The word necessary and need and require appear throughout that letter. And so the idea that the explanation that Traymore was getting from Ms. Tracy as to what this records request was all about, in April of 2021, Ms. Tracy, or the trust, whoever was the appropriate requestor, and there is still, I think, some doubt about that, injected that issue into the case from the very beginning. And there may have been argument at trial about that.
But do you agree that as to what we're supposed to find, we are not supposed to find that they were necessary?
Necessary is not an element of the statute. I can certainly concede that, Justice Triana, but I don't think you can divorce the claimant, the relator's own allegations in this case about what this records request was all about from the whole thing. I think you've got to consider what the substance of the request was, assuming that this was even a proper request to start with. So, no, the agreed. The statute does not say necessary, but that was the way that the relators framed this request from day one. And in fact, not only that, but they continued that framing in their amended. It's not a petition per se. It's a mandamus in the trial court is a weird concept, right? Their application for mandamus relief. The other thing, and I'll, on that point, Justice Triana, I'll go ahead and launch into that this was not a static records request. The request was made by someone, by a law firm, where there was no testimony linking that letter to any authority to actually send it in the trial court. But the letter did go out. Clark Hill sent the letter out, and it had a big universe of documents that were being sought. One category, request for purposes of valuation. Okay, that was one of the first lines, and I think the second paragraph of the letter. But there were also nine other categories or nine other purposes stated in that letter. Well, over a period of time, and after, including after this action was brought to enforce a right to inspect books and records, Ms. Tracy and the trust winnowed that purpose down. And when they did that, and this is by virtue of their amended pleadings, because as in any other lawsuit, you can only get what you ask for in the pleadings. The judgment has to conform to the pleadings. Here, the word necessary was not only stated in the initial request, it was also stated in the third amended petition on which this action is based. The language that even the lawyers used over time in terms of winnowing down the scope of the request also included necessary. So in fairness to Judge Mazzi, all she was doing was imposing upon the claimants, the relators, the very standard that they acknowledged they were holding themselves to in the petition.
And do you agree that, let's assume we all agree that Ms. Tracy has no standing to sue, the trust does?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm gonna make sure I understand your question. So I don't think there's any dispute, there is no dispute, let me say, that in the divorce that Ms. Tracy acquired the LP interests and that she conveyed those LP interests, limited partnership interests, to the trust. So with respect to all the claims to which Texas law applies here, there's no dispute that the trust was the proper entity to make that request. We disagree about California law and its application to this case, in large part because Judge Mazzi found there were two critical fact findings made that, and I believe one was 24, and if I can lay my hands on the other number, I will certainly do that. But Judge Mazzi found that there was no evidence presented that either the trust or Ms. Tracy had was a shareholder or had a corporate interest in Tramore Properties, Inc., which is the only entity for which there's been an argument advanced that California law should apply in this proceeding. And so, and I don't believe that there was any attack levied at those fact findings. And so I think our position, Tramore's position, would be the court's bound by those findings unless there's an attack levied on those. If there wasn't, then California law is just simply out of the case. And there would be no basis for reversing and remanding with respect to California law, which does create, I think, a host of issues. If we're gonna talk about California law, I'll go ahead and address that.
Well, maybe I misread the brief, but I thought that y'all were not arguing that California law was not the right law to apply as to TPI Inc., the California corporation. Mm-hmm. I thought that y'all kind of focused on there's no harm.
Well, we did, but backing up beyond that, if we're going to talk about standing can be raised for the first time on appeal. It's not waivable. And so if the court is going to inquire about standing, I think it's important to to get into that and to address that question specifically.
But not because it's a trust versus, my question had to do, I thought there was some argument that she doesn't even have a right to these, only the trust does, which it's like, okay, but the trust is here too, okay. So what are we arguing?
No, I understand your question now, and I recall that you asked that at the beginning of the appellant's argument. There is no question with respect to the limited partnership interest at all. We agree, and in terms of what difference that makes, whether it's the trust or Ms. Tracy with respect to the limited partnership interest, it could be a matter of what goes back if there's a remand.
Okay.
If Ms. Tracy had no standing, then of course her claims, any claims, shouldn't go back on remand. That would be inappropriate. But it's not only that. So we'll concede that the trust owns the LP interest.
But you are further stating as to standing that
yes.
California law is not proper because the trust does not have an interest in the California company.
I think we have conceded that the trust is a California, not the trust, excuse me, the company, TPI or Tramore Properties, Inc., is a California corporation. They're relying on that and the internal affairs doctrine to argue for the application of California law. All fine and good. I don't know that I can really disagree with that. But the question really is, who had standing to bring the claim? Who had standing to request the records? And all I'm hearing from the appellants is California law applies because TPI is a California corporation and they were represented here. Well, were they? I can't tell, and it's not consistent with Judge Mazzi's findings. Finding of fact 24 and I think 74 too. I don't want to quote myself on that. That would be dangerous.
That specifically found that the trust did not have an interest in TPI.
There was a finding. Well, let's keep in mind what the standard of review is here and how the evidence was presented. They specifically found that there was no evidence that either Ms. Tracy or the trust had any beneficial or, let me make sure I say this right, had demonstrated any interest in Tramore Properties Incorporated. And frankly, just getting to the bottom of it, if that is true, and those findings I believe are unchallenged, then Tramore Properties Inc., there would be no proper records request for either Ms. Tracy or the trust to Tramore Properties Inc., and therefore there can be nothing for TPI that would go back on remand. But since we're talking, I mean, I understand that California law is important to the appellant's position. But since we're talking about that, I want to address a couple of other points as to that. And first is that we would take the position that the demand was defective. And remember, this is all Ms. Tracy and or the trust's burden to show. Not only that she had standing, but also, and I'll just use she to incorporate both. I know it's confusing, but not only that she had standing, but also that she presented a proper request. Okay, they take their position on what that looks like under Texas law. That's fine. But they're really hanging their hat a lot on California law. And so they had the burden then to show that they made a proper request under California law. What does California law require that perhaps Texas does not? Well, a California statute says that there's, I think.
Are you arguing that her stated purpose that was necessary for the valuation of her interest in the corporations, that that's not a, on its face, is not a proper?
No, that's not what I'm arguing.
Okay.
I'm talking again about what was the trigger? What obligated Tramore, the entire umbrella, the LPs and the company, to respond in a way that would obligate them to provide records to Ms. Tracy or just Tracy. So no, I'm not taking that position, Your Honor. What I am saying is, if we're gonna look at California law, then we have to look at whether, and it's her burden, to show that she made a proper request. We have issues with what the appellants say in their brief about how this letter, Plaintiff's Exhibit 6, was admitted for all purposes. We don't think that's accurate at all. We think the court can look at the record. It's only, I believe, 4 pages or 6 pages in the transcript where it's clearly said, Mr. Bishop, trial counsel objected to the admission of this letter. The reason offered for admissibility of it, when they had no sponsoring witness, there was no way to authenticate it, there was a hearsay objection drawn. The whole reason why this letter was admitted into evidence, it wasn't admitted for all purposes or to show on its face that the purpose was in fact valid. It was that anything that was met or the requirements under the statute. It was presented for the purpose of showing that there had in fact been a request made. And this is, the court decided a case a few years ago. Chief Justice Byrne and Justice Triana, you were on the panel, the Gallo case, where the court recognized that there
don't
could
remember
be.
Remember it, but I'm sure we were.
Well,
right.
I hate to tell you this, Judge, but you actually authored it, so it's good to have a moment of levity at argument. But getting back to the point I am making, Your Honor, there has to be a proper request. Okay, was that Plaintiff's Exhibit 6 a proper request? It was admitted for the purpose of showing that there was a request made. And of course, it cites the Texas statute, it cites California law. But what else did it have to do? Let's look at the California statute and what it requires. California statute says, and there was an amendment that broadened this a little, but the California statute says you can seek to inspect.
But Mr. Smith, I'm getting confused.
Okay.
Because y'all are arguing California law is not applicable at all.
Yes.
She doesn't have an interest. And,
yes.
But then you're showing me how the demand is defective.
Yes.
Under California law.
Correct.
So do you want me to apply California law or not?
I don't. I'm giving you another reason to not apply California.
Okay.
That's the clarification, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I'll be brief because it's important. And here's why it's important. Even if she did have standing, she still didn't establish a proper request. That's the issue. So, and the reason why there was no proper request established under California law is that the request itself did not seek to inspect or copy records at the company office. That's what the California statute says. That is what authorities, case law out of California, there's a case called Jara versus Suprema Meats, 121 Cal App 4th, 1238, that says a request that doesn't trigger the statutory methods for obtaining documents is insufficient as a matter of law and in fact doesn't even require a response. So you can see from that strong language that I just gave the court that it is a significant issue whether this is in fact a proper request. We heard from the appellants that, well, all they had to do was say, here are your records and here's what we're going to charge you. Well, if California law applies as they say it does, they didn't even owe her that. And so it's really important to understand that distinction. I'm sorry, Justice Triana, if I've confused you in that regard. Now, I do need to clarify, because I mentioned that same statute, this is 1601 of the California Code, that there was an amendment. And there was an amendment that allowed, alternatively to inspecting the records at the company office, which was not requested, is nowhere to be found in Plaintiff's Exhibit 6 or anywhere else in any of the pleadings. You can also alternatively request that they be produced by mail or electronically. Let me know. Let's coordinate the production of this information. Is not a request for this alternative method under 1601A1 of the California statute to inspect books and records at the company office. Now, admittedly, I will say that I looked for cases that construed that provision. It's a relatively recent amendment. There were none, but I think it's a fair application of the Jara case, which says you don't even have to respond if they don't tell you a way that you're required to do this under the statute to give over these documents. It's a fair reading to say she had to do one of those two things in the request. She had to say, I'll come inspect them at the corporate office and I'll copy them. Or my representative will, an agent will, or please, I will trigger the alternate request method. Please provide these to me by mail or electronically, and I will pay.
So can we go on to why you are arguing that it's an improper request under Texas law?
Yes, we can. Again, the point I want to emphasize before I get into that, Your Honor, is that again, you've got to apply the standard of review here. And in every element of this claim, other than perhaps the one that we're discussing now, Ms. Tracy and the trust bore the burden of proof at trial, which considering where we are, is She's now got to show conclusive, she's got to bring forward conclusive evidence for this court to reverse and do, well, to reverse at all on the Texas claim, with the possible exception of the element that we're about to discuss. And that's why I wanted to frame the procedure that the court is looking at, or the lens that this court has to look at this case under, as applying the proper standard of review. Because, you know, opposing counsel, and I understand why she would do this, is standing up and making basically a de novo argument to the court, or an argument that assumes that the standard of review is not conclusive evidence. Remember, what evidence was presented at trial before the motion for judgment was granted? The plaintiff's exhibit 6, which is the letter, and we say it was for the limited purpose of showing that there had been a request. Deposition excerpts from the president of Tremor, or Tremor Properties, TPI, excuse me, and Ms. Bowen, the CFO. That is all of the evidence that was presented. So I think this court has to take a really close look at, do they meet their burden of conclusive evidence under that standard? Justice Mazzi was certainly entitled to consider the witness's credibility and make determinations off of that. She made the decision that she did. And in a bench trial, it's true that she's not only going to review when there's a motion for judgment, like Mr. Bishop moved for here, the standard review is, it's not only what is a matter of law was presented or not presented, there's no evidence, but the standard is that the court is presumed to have made all the necessary credibility determinations for all the witnesses. And so this is not a clean slate. This is apply the standard of review to where there's a burden that they show things conclusively. Now, there is, I will concede, we did talk about in our brief, Justice Triano, that they had to show conclusively also whether there was a proper purpose. I think in looking at the statute, it does describe this as an affirmative defense. And I want to make sure I have the language down explicitly for the court. It is a defense to an action that the claimant was not acting in good faith or for a proper purpose in making the person's request for examination. I think a reasonable reading of that statute is to say that the burden of proof on that defensive issue did fall on Tremor. There's been discussion, Ms. Milios talked about the testimony of Mr. Bowen and, Ms. Bowen and the president, and how this was all conclusory evidence. Well, again, consider the standard of review.
Mr. Smith, I have a quick question, really quick question.
I don't know, my time is up.
I hope it's a quick question. Given the trial court found that Ms. Tracy in her individual capacity has no ownership interest, mm-hmm. how does the partnership agreement's attorney's fees provision apply to her? Should we modify the judgment to reflect that only the trust can be held liable for the attorney's fees?
That is a very interesting question that I had not thought of before standing here, Justice Ellis. I think if that was requested specifically in appellant's brief, I think that's something that the court could do. I'm not sure that that actually was requested. I think the remedy that was sought for attorney's fees was a reverse and remand for further proceedings. I think there is something even more than that requested. I think they say, well, you should render judgment. Well, as the court knows from all the attorney's fee cases that come before it, that I've yet to see a court render a judgment when there is some evidence of attorney's fees presented. The question is going to be either, well, and we can't even get into attorney's fees because my time is up, but if the court agrees that there was some, and backing up from that, Justice Ellis, I want to make sure that I address your question. If the issue is, are attorney's fees recoverable at all? Then I suppose the court, if it were properly requested by the appellants, could modify the judgment to have that apply only to the entity holding the limited partner interest. I don't think I could disagree with that if that's the court's suggestion.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yes. So I'm going to go back to my question.
Yes.
What is the evidence that you have to show, now that we've agreed that the burden shifts to y'all to show that it's an improper request? What evidence do you have to show that the request was improper?
Well.
Under Texas law, not under California.
I want to make sure I get this right, Judge, because there's I see a distinction. Was the request proper? And that to me is a different shade than was there a proper purpose stated in the request? So.
I'm asking the second part.
You're asking, what evidence do we have to show that when the request was made, it was not a proper purpose?
Correct.
I think my first response to that is, I don't think it matters because that request was amended, and by the time it went to trial, it had changed so much because of the way that it had been narrowed by virtue of the pleading amendments, that if the court looks at the scope of Exhibits A and B to Plaintiff's Exhibit 6 versus the scope of the petition, paragraph 16 of the third amended petition, there are things in the third amended petition that aren't included in the original request. And it was narrowed down so much, we did have testimony from Ms. Bowen that Ms. Tracy already had the vast majority of the information that she had requested. She requested it again. So I think to get straight to your question, the implication, and again, this is Judge Mazzi making this decision based on the credibility of witnesses. And by the way, Ms. Tracy wasn't there to testify, to tell her side of the story. That's not an insignificant fact. Judge Mazzi was making a decision based on the witnesses in front of her. And the witness in front of her said she already had all this stuff, at least 80% of it, 90% of it. And we had given over a lot of it even before this letter was ever sent. And so I think that, along with the testimony that Ms. Bowen viewed this as harassing, along with the testimony from the president that there was information in there that couldn't be possibly even related to valuation, I think that gets us there. That all we had to do, to wrap up, all we had to do, Justice Triana, is show a scintilla of evidence that the request was not for a proper purpose and was not just and reasonable. And those are really two different standards. I think Judge Mazzi had enough information based on the scant record in front of her and the witness testimony to make that determination and finding. That said, again, I would ask the court to hold the appellants to to the standard of review and require them to show that they had to establish as a matter of law all the other elements of the claim that they've brought before this court. It is not a do-over. The court is frankly constrained by the standard of review, and so is Ms. Tracy and the trust. So we would ask the court to affirm the judgment with respect to the Texas LPs and the records request on those for all the reasons stated today and in our brief. We'd also ask the court to affirm, or I suppose could dismiss if it determines that there was in fact no standing to bring claims on behalf of the California Corporation. And for the reasons stated in our brief, we'd also ask the court to affirm potentially with a remittiter, and I know I'm opening a new can of worms here, and I will not, the attorney's fees award presented because, frankly, nobody wants to go back and try this again. So unless the court has further questions, my time is far over. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. From the appellant. Yes, ma'am.
Let's get right to the standard of review. The standard of review depends on who bears the burden of proof. Tramore bore the burden of proof to show an improper purpose. That means Molly only has to show on appeal that no evidence supports the trial court's finding. She does not have to show conclusive evidence on improper purpose. That's from Graham Central Station versus Pena and this court's decision in Beacons Van Lines versus Kahn. And the site for that one is 717 Southwest 3rd, 86. There is no evidence that Molly acted with an improper purpose. Justice Triana, you just heard a lot of conversation about all the stuff that went on in this case. You didn't hear a word about misusing corporate records to compete with Tramore, trying to bring Tramore down, misusing Tramore's funds. No. All they have is they didn't like it. And all they had to do was give her the records and charge her for the hassle. The insistence that Molly Tracy's trust did not show at trial that Molly Tracy's trust owns the interest in TPI is astonishing to me. Tramore amended its pleading, or its answer and its counterclaim, a couple of months before trial to plead that Molly Tracy's trust owns 16.667% of TPI. Those pages are at Clerk's Record 5412 and 547. In the music case from the Texas Supreme Court that we cited in our reply, that is conclusive proof that that Molly's trust owns the interest that in TPI that Tramore admitted the trust owns. Molly had no burden to come forward with any other evidence or even introduce those pleadings at trial.
So your position is that she owns 16% of TPI?
Molly's trust.
Yes, correct.
Just to be clear, yes, 16.667% of TPI. Tramore has admitted that. That's the end of that story. Now, the trial court didn't apply California law. So standing here and dickering about whether Molly met specific requirements of California law is truly beside the point. Molly's entitled to a new trial. As to Molly's letter, this was at the peak of COVID. So to demand that Molly be permitted to come into the Tramore offices to copy records would have been absurd. Furthermore, the evidence in the record is uncontroverted. Ms. Bowen testified that all of TPI's records are in the cloud. So there wasn't any place for Molly to go and sit and copy records. Tramore knows that. All it had to do was coordinate with Molly on how to get the records that she wanted. My final point on this is that, actually I have two final points if I, nope. No, I have time. Do I have time? I can't see the thing.
You didn't, nothing,
it does, it's still at five.
Nothing is on. Nothing is on. You have time.
Let me make two final points. I apologize for that. I looked up and I was like, oh, wait a minute, there's no lights. Molly stated what was necessary, that she needed records necessary for evaluation. That can't elevate Molly's statutory purpose. If Molly, as a layperson, used the word necessary or needed or wanted or desired, that is irrelevant. That doesn't change Molly's statutory entitlement to records, and it certainly can't change the trial court's obligation to apply the law correctly. And finally, yes, Molly's April 2021 letter was, over the course of time, streamlined. Tramore has at times argued, and I think I heard shadows of that today, that somehow that shows Molly acted with an improper purpose. Molly streamlined and reduced the request of the records that she wanted starting in April 2021 because Tramore consistently through this litigation gave Molly records. So for Tramore to argue, as it did in the trial court, that Molly had everything she needed and this lawsuit was unnecessary, defies the record. It defies their own statements in court and it defines the pleadings. In Tramore's motion for summary judgment, it attached Exhibit B at 2413 of the clerk's record. And this is under Texas Supreme Court precedent and admission, a judicial admission that Tramore gave Molly records, multiple documents, after Molly filed suit through August of 2022. So yes, Molly modified or amended her petition to reduce the scope of the record she was requesting that was directly related to the fact that Tramore was slowly but surely leaking out documents that Molly was entitled to have from the very beginning. That again, it could have provided her without all of this and just charged her for the process.
I have another attorney's fees question.
Sure.
How do you respond to Appley's argument that you have not preserved error on the issue of segregation of attorney's fees, the recoverable versus non-recoverable?
I disagree, obviously. The parties briefed segregation after trial. The trial counsel raised segregation while Mr. Bishop was on the stand shortly after. The trial court said, well, she objected to the lack of segregation, and the trial court stated, noted. Now, okay, the trial court didn't say objection overruled, but that is good enough. And furthermore, the parties, as we detailed in our brief, this all happened on a very quick turnaround. I mean, we went from start to finish with very little time. I don't think anybody was ready to present or receive the attorney's fees evidence. And so in the days after trial, the parties briefed the attorney's fees issue in which Molly's counsel made clear that we had a problem with the segregation. Tramore did not segregate properly. It only admitted that it should segregate out claims, its non-suited counterclaims for right of first refusal. But even then, it didn't segregate all of the right of first refusal fees. It didn't segregate other non-suited counterclaims, including wanting a declaration that Tramore had never violated the partnership agreements. Tramore also requested and recovered its attorney's fees for its failed mandamus in this court, and it recovered fees for records that it produced to Molly during the litigation, as I just discussed a minute ago. And it sought and recovered fees that it incurred months before Molly even filed her letter. So on top of that and the inadequate records, this court, at a minimum, should reverse and remand for a new trial on attorney's fees. But we ask the court to reverse and remand, instructing that either California law applies and give Molly a proper chance for a proper trial under the correct standard.
So are you asking for us just to reverse and remand and say, okay, apply California law and do it over? Or are you asking, what exactly are you wanting us to do?
If the court concludes that that California law should apply to TPI, I think that's the only remedy the court can give. I don't know that the court can make any conclusions of law, because Molly wasn't given an opportunity to make her case under California law. California law just wasn't applied. We would submit that on its face, as I think you've alluded, Justice Triana, valuing an interest is related to the interest. So if Molly's interest is related to the interest, then she is entitled to records under California law, subject to the specifics that Tramore's counsel has discussed here. But we didn't get into those in the trial court because the trial court didn't apply California law, and the proof at trial was not directed at California law because she denied the motion for to apply California law prior to trial. So that just wasn't on the menu.
So you're not asking that under Texas law for us to reverse and render?
No, I think under you should reverse. I mean, I think you can do either, but for either reasons or both, and the court should reverse under Texas law. To the extent the court is concerned, and this would be accurate, that the limited partnerships are governed by Texas law, then it would be appropriate for this court to reverse and remand under Texas law as well, because the standard was improperly applied to them as well. My only point was, if the court holds that California law applies, effectively back at trial, we think there will be less to fight about. But we do ask the court to reverse and remand for both under both state statutes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. The court will stand in recess, and this case is submitted. Thank you.